Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Undisclosed This Week, in which it is all about Adnan. Hey, before I tell you about the sponsors, I want to remind you that the Adnan Syed Legal Defense Trust is still raising money for his defense. I'll tell you a little bit more in the credits about how you can donate to Adnan's defense fund. But for now, I want to tell you about our great sponsors, who include Warby Parker, our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron, and longtime sponsor of the show, Stamps.com. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show, and be sure to support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
In 1999, shortly after Adnan Syed was arrested for the murder of Haman Lee, his attorneys applied for bail. As a juvenile with no record and all factors in his favor, there was a possibility it could be granted, though in any such case, bail is always hard to come by. In his case, though, it was made harder because the state argued against it because of his religion and ethnicity. And then it was made impossible because his charging documents got a very important fact about Adnan wrong. But just last week, nearly 18 years after the fiasco in 1999, Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, filed for bail again.
A classic 1961 article in the Yale Law Journal notes that, since the general notion of bail pending trial antedates recorded English law, its original raison d'etre is not altogether certain. It probably arose from the medieval sheriff's desire to avoid the costly and troublesome burden of personal responsibility for those in his charge. Trials were delayed by the infrequent visits of itinerant justices, and many accused died because of the unsanitary conditions in the prisons. And now in modern-day society, with the amount of violence occurring in many prisons, the risk to prisoners has been compounded. After Judge Welch issued his order granting Adnan a new trial, Rabia wasn't initially able to get in touch with him because his prison was on lockdown. This was because there was a brawl that had broken out among 26 inmates using improvised weapons that was exacerbated and perhaps even caused by staffing shortages that had been noted numerous times. Similar issues led the Department of Justice to recently file an amicus brief in a case out of Calhoun, Georgia, arguing that the state's bail system is unconstitutional and exposes too many inmates to the ills of pretrial detention. Likely in response to this brief, the Maryland Attorney General's office recently filed an opinion asserting that the state's bail system is also likely unconstitutional and that bail should more readily be given and at lower amounts than under the status quo. It's against this current backdrop that the same Attorney General's office now must respond to a bail motion in Adnan's case.
On Monday, October 24th, Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, filed a motion for release pending appeal in Adnan's case. The motion was filed pursuant to Section 7109(b)(2) of the Maryland Code of the Criminal Appeal, which says, if the attorney general states an intention to file an application for appeal, the circuit court may, one, stay the order, and two, set bail for the petitioner. It's a pretty robust motion. It's got 38 attached exhibits. And as the motion notes, Judge Welch entered an order granting Adnan a new trial. And the state attorney general afterwards filed an application for leave to appeal, meaning that it's now in Judge Welch's discretion whether to grant Adnan bail and release him from imprisonment while the rest of the appeals process plays out. As the motion notes, Judge Welch has this discretion because he granted Adnan a new trial, meaning that Adnan is now like any other person awaiting trial with the presumption of innocence. And specifically, the motion cites to a Supreme Court of Rhode Island case, Clark versus Moran, where a defendant was granted bail after his murder conviction was reversed on appeal. As in that case, Judge Welch has had this discretion because it's not a capital murder case. Justin notes how in 1999, Adnan was initially denied pretrial release based on the judge's heavy reliance on the state's misstatement in the charging document that Adnan was actually an 18-year-old adult, eligible for the death penalty, instead of a 17-year-old juvenile. Justin then notes in his motion how there was a review of the bail determination on March 31st, 1999. Now, the capital punishment argument was off the table. So, Assistant State's Attorney Vicky Walsh now claimed that bail should be denied because there was a pattern in the United States where young Pakistani males have been jilted, have committed murder, and fled to Pakistan, and we have been unable to extradite them back. Later, Walsh had to admit that these statements were fabrications. There was no pattern of jilted young Pakistani males committing murder. There was no pattern of charged Pakistani males fleeing the country, and there was no pattern of failed extradition of Pakistani males who had fled the country. But, as Justin Brown notes, the damage had been done, and Sayyid has been locked up ever since.
In Maryland, as in all jurisdictions, a judge has two primary concerns when trying to determine whether or not someone should be released pending trial or appeal. The first is whether or not they're a flight risk, and the second is whether or not they're a danger to the community. In terms of the flight risk prong, the judge has to consider whether a released defendant will flee the jurisdiction, and in terms of danger to the community, the judge is looking at whether the community at large and or specific members of the community would be put in danger if the accused were to be released, or whether the defendant is likely to conduct himself as a law-abiding citizen for the duration of the time until his hearing or trial. It does not appear that the Maryland courts have ever stated the burden of proof that the prosecution has to meet before the judge can be allowed to detain a defendant based on the defendant being a flight risk. But as Justin's motion notes, a judge can order a defendant detained under the based upon a danger to the community theory only if the judge is persuaded by clear and convincing evidence that no condition or combination of conditions of pretrial release can reasonably protect against the danger that the defendant presents against an identifiable potential victim and or to the community. In other words, to detain a defendant based on the defendant being a danger, the judge must first conclude the defendant poses a danger and, second, conclude that the conditions that the judge could impose, such as house arrest or electronic monitoring, would not be sufficient to diminish that danger. In making these determinations, Maryland judges considered the criteria listed in Maryland Court Rule 4-216E1. And Justin argues in his brief how several of these factors support a non's release, and he backs up each of these factors with documentation and exhibits.
I'm really excited about our new sponsor, Warby Parker. Now, earlier this year, I needed a new pair of glasses, and I was really dissatisfied by the poor quality and high price of the options out there. But then I talked to a friend and colleague, and she said she found a great alternative in the website Warby Parker. According to her, the website was really easy to navigate, and she got a really terrific pair of glasses for a very low price. Warby Parker's a cool company. Their name's based upon the personal journals of one of my favorite authors, Jack Kerouac, and here's the concept. By cutting out the middleman and selling directly to customers online and in their stores, Warby Parker is able to provide high-quality, great-looking eyewear at a mere fraction of the usual price. Their prescription glasses start at $95. That's all in. It includes frames, lenses, and coatings. In fact, recently I got my own pair. It's actually the Collin frames. Only $95, really easy process, really great pair of glasses. Now you might be thinking, how can you possibly buy eyeglasses online? Well, with Warby Parker's completely free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs of glasses online, have them shipped directly to your home or office, then you have 5 days to try them on, show them to friends and family for an honest opinion on what looks best. It's 100% free and really easy. Then, when you find a pair of glasses you like, simply go to warbyparker.com/undisclosed and order your favorite pair. So head to Warby Parker, that's warbyparker.com/undisclosed to see my current favorite frames. Get started with your free home try-on today. You can choose the 5 frames you like to try on, mail the frames back, choose your favorite pairs to have your prescription added to the order, and that's it. Warby Parker makes your experience completely risk-free, and there's free shipping all around. So visit warbyparker.com/undisclosed to begin your free home try-on experience today. So one of the factors that a judge considers in deciding whether to detain or grant bail is the danger of the defendant to the alleged victim, another person, the victim, or himself. And as Justin notes in his motion, first, quite clearly, Adnan had no history of violence whatsoever at the time of his arrest as a 17-year-old back in 1999. And then second, in the next 17 years, despite being locked up in a maximum security prison for several of those years as a teenager with many dangerous individuals, and in essence in one of the most violent places in our society, Adnan has not been cited for a single violent incident. Instead, according to all the records, he has availed himself of all of the limited educational opportunities at his prison and has been described as, quote, an excellent worker who, quote, requires minimal supervision and, quote, volunteers for all lockdowns and any other jobs he can help out with. Motion also notes that the only infraction he's had in 17 years was being in possession of a cell phone, but otherwise those records show he is, quote, always very respectful to staff. So I think, Robbie and Susan, on this front, it's pretty clear that Adnan has demonstrated throughout his entire life he's not a violent person, and I don't think that there's any identifiable risk the state can point to, other than the charges, obviously, in this case, that would show that he would have any tendency to be violent toward anyone if he's released.
And, you know, I know a number of people who were incarcerated with him who've come forward in the last couple of years and talked about Adnan and just his reputation in the prison, and that he's very well liked, and he's very, you know, he's basically just friendly. He's non-confrontational. He's not aggressive. Just last week, I was on a panel at Georgetown University, and the professor invited me there, Mark Howard. He teaches at Jessup, and he said that when he was teaching his class at Jessup, some of the inmates said, oh, yeah, you know, Serial came up, and they said, you know what, we remember him. We remember Syed, and he's a great guy, and he got along with everybody. So definitely going to be very difficult for the state to show that he would be a danger, has ever been a danger, given his reputation.
Yeah, and it's tough to point to any sort of general statistics in terms of detention of people charged with murder, because a huge proportion of those have criminal records, they have violent acts in their past, and so very much he is an anomaly in the sense that while he's been charged with this crime, there is nothing in his record otherwise to indicate that he would ever hurt anyone.
The second factor Justin notes in his motion is the defendant's family ties, employment status and history, financial resources, reputation, character and mental condition, length of residence in the community, and the length of residence in the state. And these are all fairly straightforward factors. In terms of residence in the state, Adnan was born in Maryland in 1981 and has lived here for each of the past 35 years. With regard to his mental condition, Adnan has never been diagnosed with a mental illness, and Justin notes in his motion that Adnan has retained a social worker who's experienced in assisting prisoners in transition from the general population of a prison to the regular population of the rest of society. In terms of character evidence and reputation, well, I mentioned some things before, but this motion again notes that Adnan has no history of violence and he enjoys a great reputation among the prison staff, his family, and the community. And I can say this, that nearly every time I've gone to visit him as we've headed in, some member of the prison staff has always said, oh, you're here to meet Syed, great guy. The motion also includes in the exhibits all the certificates that Adnan has gotten for study programs, volunteering, his behavior, and commendations from prison staff for his actual work. The motion also notes that Adnan's friends and family have stuck with him through thick and thin and would provide a support system upon his release.
Yeah, the interesting thing for me is, I guess, a couple points. One, the social worker actually works at the University of Maryland School of Law, so I think she'd be a fairly strong witness at this bail hearing to be able to explain to the judge exactly why this would be a good case for release. And then secondly, we've sort of gone through and said how you have these jailhouse informants and it's often the police and the prosecution rounding them up to testify against an inmate. It'll be interesting to see the extent to which Justin is able at the bail hearing to maybe call other inmates or staff to, in this case, actually speak to Adnan's good character and why he would be a good candidate for release.
Is that common practice to be able to call inmates or prison staff, you know, to prove good character? I mean, I didn't know that can actually be done.
It's so rare in this case because, I mean, usually you're dealing with a case where the person is just, they've only been in prison or jail for a few days, and the question is, do we detain or release them pending trial? Yeah, whereas in this case, he has a history of, 17 years in the prison where these people have seen him over a decade and a half, some of them. And I think in that case, they would be valuable people who could be called. I'm not sure because it's such, again, such a unique scenario here with the new trial being granted.
Well, the flip side is, who else can a non-call? No one else has spent daily life with him as an adult. No one else could actually speak to his character now or to any risk he'd pose.
Except Rabia. Rabia would be a good person to call, I would guess. You might be on the witness list.
If I don't get sequestered somehow.
Right.
Yeah, but they're going to argue. They could easily argue. Well, you know what? All she sees him is like on the phone and the visitations, which isn't his like normal daily behavior. So she can't vouch for what it'd be like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. I mean, we could. I wonder if we submitted like the letters he's written over the years to me and other people to show evidence of kind of like, you know, how he thinks, what he's doing. But, you know, if they called anybody, I haven't heard from anybody in the prison who's, or anybody who's been incarcerated with him or has known him in this time who's had anything really negative to say about him.
The third factor that Justin's brief looked at was any other factor bearing on the risk of a willful failure to appear and the safety of the alleged victim, another person or the community, including all prior convictions and adjudications of delinquency that occurred within 3 years of the date that the defendant is charged as an adult. Adnan has no convictions other than the ones that have been invalidated based upon Judge Welch's recent opinion. And Justin also notes that Adnan's friends and family have come forward and are willing to offer bail worth approximately $1 million. That's what's typically known as a forfeiture agreement, meaning that these friends and family would forfeit their property if Adnan were to flee to avoid facing trial. The thinking here is, of course, that Adnan would not do that and would not cause all of his friends and family that have supported him to lose their homes if he were to not show up again at court. And in Justin's motion, he also discusses a few other recent developments in Maryland law. For instance, in the past 2 decades, not a single juvenile lifer in Maryland has been paroled. So basically, up until a couple weeks ago, when a judge was considering whether to grant release to a juvenile charged with a crime that carries a life sentence, the judge had to consider the inherent flight risk that applies with the defendant when he faces a conviction that would essentially be a guaranteed life behind bars sentence. Then back in April, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit challenging the state's parole system for juveniles, alleging that the current setup is unconstitutional because even though it's not technically life without parole, it is in practice life without parole because there's no meaningful chance for release. The Maryland Parole Commission said it plans to hold hearings in the next year for nearly 300 inmates who are sentenced to life for crimes they committed as juveniles. So in terms of the bail motion, as Justin notes, in the event that Adnan were convicted again on retrial, he'd be eligible for parole and work release after serving only 8 more years. That makes Adnan much less of a flight risk than he would have been a mere 3 weeks ago, when his conviction upon retrial would have been essentially a life sentence. And Justin notes 2 additional factors that cut against flight risk. First, Adnan has received a string of favorable opinions from the Maryland courts, meaning there is reason to predict more favorable outcomes in the future. And second, given the publicity that Adnan and his case have received in the media, it would be really difficult for Adnan to disappear at this point. So without a passport to leave the country and having, you know, a great deal of notoriety, his odds of living on the run wouldn't be so great.
So on the ACLU's lawsuit and then the Maryland Parole Commission's response to that, they're going to start holding hearings to review these cases and these juveniles. I mean, I know Adnan has said that a number of people he's incarcerated with, and I don't know if he's been assigned yet, but have been assigned like kind of a caseworker to start reviewing their stuff. But the ACLU's response to the Maryland Parole Commission is that they're worried that this is going to be kind of just a cursory thing, and it's just kind of going through the motions to satisfy the challenge of unconstitutionality, but there won't really be any meaningful that comes out of it, unless you have a situation where, I mean, you know, somebody served quite a lengthy sentence, and then they also have to kind of admit to their guilt, right, and admit remorse. I mean, these are things that the parole board looks for. So in a situation like Adnan's, where he's maintaining innocence, that would be really complicated.
Yeah, that definitely cuts against Justin's argument a bit, admittedly, the sense that exactly as you say, Rabia, there's no indication whatsoever that Adnan would ever say that he killed Hay. And so while Justin does include that, and we do have this new provision where there's going to be bail hearings, it's exceedingly unlikely he would, in fact, be paroled if he continued to maintain his innocence.
But there's kind of like two arguments here, right? I mean, there's two arguments, meaning that go for Adnan not having to serve so much time anyways. One is that if his case is reviewed under this new ACLU stuff and the parole board decides to give him parole, well, then he'd be out anyways. Or if he actually is granted a new trial and is convicted again, he still wouldn't have that many more years to serve. So why would he flee? So there's almost two different possible scenarios, I think, that Justin's trying to present that could play out, you know, whether or not Adnan got the bail. But, you know, one question I have is, if Adnan's case comes up for one of these parole hearings fairly soon and it's reviewed and they decide to parole him, what does that do to the conviction being overturned? Does that kind of effectively end his sentence? Or would he still have to go back? He's been released on parole. Would he still be tried again?
I don't think he could be eligible for parole while his conviction has been overturned. So in other words, I don't think he could be paroled unless the conviction were reinstated. So I think it's an either or. Either we're going to have the order granting him a new trial finalized and the state drops it or some type of plea deal and that ends the matter, or the appellate courts reinstate the conviction or there's a conviction upon retrial and that's the point at which you would have a parole hearing.
And they're not relevant to Adnan's case, but there actually have been some interesting developments recently in Maryland regarding bail issues. I don't know if you saw how last month when the state's attorney general, he released an opinion basically arguing against the current Maryland system in which it's not a debtor's prison exactly, but the result is the same, where you have many criminal defendants unable to afford the bail they need to be released for largely minor crimes, even with minor bails they still can't reach. And then yesterday, Colin, Robbie, did you guys see the article about the judge in Maryland who was recorded saying, essentially acknowledging she knew that the bail she was setting was preventative based on financial prohibitions. Like, they couldn't afford their bail, and she knew that and set the bail for that reason. Like, just to clarify, that's absolutely not what bail is supposed to be. It's supposed to be that the money or the monetary bond is sort of an insurance to get you coming back. It's not supposed to be a bar where they know in advance that you're not going to make that bail, so too bad you can't leave. You're supposed to be able to leave with the extra incentive of not losing your money.
Yeah, there's this Supreme Court case. It's a Red Scare communism, McCarthyism era case, Stack versus Boyle. And that was exactly what the Supreme Court found in that case, that the judge, in effect, was punishing this defendant because he thought that she was a communist or a communist sympathizer, and set the bail exactly as this Maryland judge. And the Supreme Court said, absolutely, you can't do that. You can't use bail as a pretext to punish someone and keep them incarcerated pending trial. Yes, that then takes us to the fourth factor cited by Justin, and this is really the heart of the motion, I would say, and that is the nature of the evidence against the defendant. And essentially, the stronger the evidence, the likelier the court's going to order the defendant detained, because that both makes him a stronger flight risk because it's likelier he's going to be convicted, and more of a risk to the community because it means it's likelier he's guilty of the crime, and in this case, certainly a violent crime. On the other hand, the weaker the evidence, the likelier the court is going to allow the defendant to be released. And in this motion, Justin notes that in ordering a new trial, Judge Welch concluded that the crux, the heart of the state's case, was the intersection among three things. One, Jay's claim that Hay was buried in Lincoln Park in the 7 o'clock hour on January 13th. Two, the Lincoln Park pings. And three, Hay's body being recovered from Lincoln Park. And really, there's two components to this conclusion. The first component is Judge Welch specifically points out this was the crux of the state's case because the rest of Jay's story was contradictory as well as contradicted by the other available evidence. And Justin, in the motion, of course, points out a few of the ways that this was true. So probably most significantly, as we've pointed out previously, he notes how Jay's trunk pop story changed from initially him seeing Hay's body in the trunk of her Sentra at a strip off of Edmondson Avenue in his first interview. That then shifts to the Best Buy parking lot in his second interview. That then shifts to his grandmother's house in the Intercept interview with Natasha Vargas Cooper in December 2014. So he sort of lays bare some of those inconsistencies that Jay has in his story. And then second, Justin, of course, digs into the current state of this trinity, this crux that Judge Welch identifies as essentially the heart of the state's case.
Yeah, and it's not just Jay's Intercept interview that's relevant here. It's also Kevin Yurick's Intercept interview, in which he, you know, agrees. This is the crux of the state's case. And Jay plus cell phone records. So the prosecutor at Anand's original trial has himself gone on the record declaring that here's what the foundation of the state's case is.
So let's go ahead and start with the first part of that crux. This was Jay's claim at trial that Hay was buried in the 7 o'clock p.m. hour. And as Justin notes, in his December 2014 Intercept interview, Jay places the burial closer to midnight, which, of course, directly contradicts his trial testimony. And I actually want to dig into this a little bit more because the change is actually even more fundamental than this. So if you go back and look at that Intercept interview, this is part one. Jay says that after Adnan and he went to Kathy's house, Adnan dropped him off at his house at about 6 o'clock p.m. Now, of course, this is fundamentally inconsistent with Jay's trial testimony, which is that Officer Adcock's call was received at Kathy's house, and that directly led Adnan and he to go to Lincoln Park to bury the body. But in this one, we have Adnan after Kathy's place dropping Jay off at home. And then, according to Jay in the Intercept interview, after Adnan dropped him off, Adnan left and didn't come back until several hours later, closer to midnight. So that's the closer to midnight language, is that that is when Adnan is actually returning to Jay's house, not when they're burying the body. So Adnan returns to Jay's place closer to midnight in Adnan's own car. Also in the story, Jay says that when Adnan comes back, he calls him on his phone, either when he is driving to Jay's house or when he's right outside. But of course, we have Adnan's call log and there's no call to Jay after 10:45 a.m. So again, a new tweak to Jay's story that is flatly contradicted by the cell phone evidence.
And can I just remind folks that what happened in the evening, according to Jay, was after Lincoln Park, Adnan dropped him off where Jen picked him up. And then he went with Jen, you know, he had a conversation with Jen that he killed her and I need to, you know, go clean off the weapon. I mean, like, all of that is gone. Jen is completely gone from this entire evening.
Not completely. Remember, she's now at Kathy's.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, Jen is now at Kathy's. So that is also shifting. So that's another inconsistency that could be used on retrial. And then additionally, Jay says, so Adnan comes back closer to midnight and calls me on his phone, even though there's no call. Adnan doesn't have digging tools. So Jay goes inside and gets some gardening tools. They then drive to Lincoln Park, where Adnan and he dig a hole in Lincoln Park for 40 minutes. And then Jay says that Adnan drives him around the corner to Hay's car, where Adnan retrieves Hay's body and spends the next 30 to 45 minutes burying her. Or at least in this version, that is what Jay says Adnan told him, because Jay, despite saying at trial he was there for the burial, now says he was smoking cigarettes and not watching or helping Adnan bury Hay's body. And so when you add all this together, it's about 5, 6, 7 new inconsistencies that Jay has created. And when you sort of add up the time and stack it, it's really the burial taking place not even close to midnight. It is well after midnight. And so, you know, overall, this first part of the crux that we have, Jay saying the burial's in the 7 o'clock hour, this has been undermined 7 ways to Sunday by Jay, where he's saying events are completely different than I said before, and the burial is not even closer to midnight. It's really after midnight.
You know, one thing that occurred to me when I first read this interview was, like, you know, it's always been about, like, why? Why is Jay changing his story again? And that's always been the big mystery. And I remember around this time is when discussions of the lividity and autopsy were actually emerging online. And I personally feel like maybe some of that information was conveyed to him, so he readjusted his story again. And I could be totally conspiratorial here, but I feel like there is a reason he shifted it again. Otherwise, there's just no reason for him to do that. I mean, it doesn't serve him at all to completely change it, to basically obliterate Jen's testimony.
I think it was conveyed to him back in 1999.
That it couldn't have happened?
You know, there's no way to know now based on the record, but there's a lot of odd ways the case adds up that to me suggests that the cops knew about this problem. They knew they had an issue with it. And I mean, that they try to repair it, for instance, by asking Jay if he and a nun ever went back to reposition the body or went back to rebury it, maybe thinking that could explain this discrepancy in their case. But combined with the appalling lack of documentation concerning the burial itself and the way they're questioning Jay about it, I think they knew. And I think Jay might have picked up on that, but was stuck with the story.
I mean, but it was a really big risk to take because, you know, if Gutierrez had been competent, like even relatively competent, she could have still easily pointed this out at trial. Like, this wouldn't have been that difficult for her, just even from, you know, the documentation, even though it's meager, that exists, for her to get the examiner to say, well, again, lividity is an issue here.
But they already knew she wouldn't do that. They already knew from the Nicholas case that the exact scenario had been presented, and she'd failed to pick up on it.
The unimpeachable source, right, had told them Gutierrez does not understand lividity evidence. And so, yeah, maybe they knew that she wouldn't challenge it.
Blue Apron, you are delicious and easy to use, and all of our fans need to know about it. Seriously, Undisclosed loves Blue Apron. Me and Robbie have been doing this cook-off battle for like 2 months now, and the joy of cooking with Blue Apron hasn't faded since day one. I'll tell you why. For me, it's the variety. Blue Apron means new recipes that are created weekly and never repeated once in the same year. You can customize your preferences on each meal, and you can get each meal for less than 10 bucks. Look, there's no weekly commitment, so you only get that delicious food delivered right to your door, right when you want it. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the very best. It's easy, easy to cook, easy to follow with step-by-step recipe cards that come to your door with each meal, and you can prepare those meals in 40 minutes or less. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free. All you gotta do is go to www.blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's right, if you're a new subscriber, you get your first 3 meals free with free shipping. You're gonna love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's www.blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Speaking of not challenging evidence, we have the second part of that crux, which is the Linkin Park pings.
Yeah, as Justin notes, the prosecution never disclosed, either to the jury or to its own expert, that the AT&T subscriber activity report that was entered into evidence had been accompanied by a disclaimer saying, outgoing calls only are reliable for location status. Any incoming calls will not be considered reliable for location. Last year, in 2015, when he was shown this disclaimer, Woronowitz stated in an affidavit that if he'd seen this critical information prior to trial, he would not have testified the way he did. The way Woronowitz had testified at Anand's trial was that the two calls that came in just after 7 o'clock at 7:09 and 7:16 p.m. had both originated on L689B, and that was consistent with Anand's phone being in the coverage range that would have included Linkin Park and the burial site. But based on that disclaimer and the knowledge that AT&T itself stated that incoming call data was not reliable, he would not have been able to give the same testimony. Without good data, he couldn't rely on it to give any conclusions about what had actually happened. And as Justin notes, this is a big deal. As the motion says, Judge Welch found in his opinion that, but for trial counsel's unprofessional error and failing to confront the state cell tower expert with this disclaimer, the result of the trial would have been different. Moreover, based on Woronowitz's affidavit, the defense's case seems even stronger for retrial because there's every reason to think that both that evidence and any testimony regarding the cell phone records would be inadmissible pursuant to Fry. And this is where Justin asked the court to consider again Kevin Urich's own proclamations in the Intercept interview that Jay's testimony alone or the cell phone evidence alone wouldn't have been enough for a conviction, and that it was only the combination of the two, which mutually reinforced and corroborated one another somehow, only that allowed the jury to find a non-guilty. Well, with neither of those things standing, now that Jay has thoroughly impeached himself and given even more stories, I think earlier Colin said 5 or 6 new inconsistencies, but that was being pretty generous. I think we're at least a dozen new ones. With both those twin pillars of the prosecution's case toppled, what's left to stand on?
The next part is, I think, I mean, for me, one of the biggest indicators of when people ask me about why do you believe Adnan is innocent? I have lots of reasons for believing Adnan is innocent other than, you know, just actually knowing him. But I feel like this is like scientific evidence that should help provide proof for people who are kind of on the fence. And that is the lividity evidence here. Now, remember, the third part of the crux of the prosecution's case was Hayes' body being found in Lincoln Park, which previously had been used to corroborate Jay's claim that there was a Lincoln Park burial in the 7 o'clock hour. Now, for the first time in a legal filing, we have a direct refutation of that claim. Dr. Leah Levati, who we first interviewed on Episode 5 in Season 1 of Undisclosed, submitted an affidavit with a motion. Dr. Levati, again, is Assistant Professor of Pathology at the University of Michigan, and she's also the Deputy Chief Medical Examiner at the Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office in Detroit. Let's start by noting that Dr. Levati has now seen all of the pertinent medical evidence and testimony in the case. Testimony of the state's medical examiner at trial, the autopsy report, the autopsy photos, the crime scene photos that were admitted at trial, and even crime scene photos that were not admitted at trial. And let's also briefly report the nature of lividity evidence. When a person dies, their heart stops pumping and blood begins pooling in the dependent or lowest portion of the body. For example, lividity will be found on the back if the person is laying on their back and on the side if the person is laying on their side. So this pattern that's formed by the blood pooling in one place is what's called lividity. So Dr. Levati notes in her affidavit that lividity begins to fix between 2 and 4 hours after death and becomes fully fixed between 8 and 12 hours after death, meaning that it's no longer going to move. If a body is moved to a different position between these two time frames, between 4 hours and 8 hours at a minimum, there's going to be a mixed pattern of lividity. So, for instance, if a person is on their back for 4 to 5 hours after death and then is placed on their side, we'd expect to see lividity patterns both on the side and on the back. Pathologists can see how the blood has moved from one place in the body to the other. On the other hand, if a body stays in the same position for 8 to 12 hours after death, we expect to see only one lividity pattern that's consistent with the dependent or the lowest portion of the body. So if a body's on its back for 8 to 12 hours after death, then they're only going to have one fixed lividity pattern on their back. So when we look at this case, Jay's claim at trial was that Hay was pretzeled up in the trunk of her Nissan Sentra for 4 to 5 hours after death. And after that, Adnan and him buried her in Lincoln Park in the 7 o'clock hour. On top of that, the autopsy report, which was co-signed by a medical examiner who was there for the disinterment of Hay's body, said that Hay was found buried on her right side. And Dr. Levati notes that crime scene photos also reflect a right side burial. And Susan, Colin, and I have all seen these photos, and we can also corroborate that it's clearly a right-side burial. Now, the problem with all of this, as Dr. Levati previously said, is that the autopsy report only indicates that there was frontal lividity, which Dr. Levati was able to see in some of the crime scene photos. For example, she notes in her affidavit that in one photograph, the body is on its right side with a view of the chest and abdomen. In this photograph, the lividity is of equal intensity on both sides of the chest. So this leads Dr. Levati to two explicit conclusions, as well as an implicit one. The first conclusion is, and I quote, based on a reasonable degree of medical, pathologic, and scientific probability, the body was in an anterior, face-down position from approximately 2 to 4 hours following her death until at least 8 hours immediately after her death, and possibly longer, resulting in fixed anterior lividity. And second, quote, the lividity pattern observed with Ms. Lee's body is not consistent with a right side burial position within 8 hours of her death, as lividity was fixed in the front of her body and not on its right side. Consequently, she could not have been buried on her right side until more than 8 hours following her death. So Justin notes in his motion that this creates a huge problem for the crux of the state's case, given that the state claimed at trial that Hay had been killed around 2:36 p.m. and might need to push that timeline further back in the event of a retrial based on Asia and other evidence. This means at the earliest, the Lincoln Park burial would have been at 10:36 p.m., which contradicts Jay's trial timeline and renders the Lincoln Park pings completely irrelevant.
Yeah, and I'd also say that from this affidavit, we have a third implicit conclusion, and that conclusion is that Hay couldn't have been pretzeled up in the trunk of her Sentra for 4 to 5 hours after death, as Jay claimed at trial, or even longer, as Jay now claims in his Intercept interview. And that's because Hay being pretzeled up seems to strongly imply she was on her side. She was about 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". A Sentra trunk is relatively small. Jay even says in one of her stories that he could see her blue lips. So all this seems to strongly indicate that Hay, according to Jay's story, was on her side in the trunk for at least 4 to 5 hours after death. And again, the Intercept interview is several hours more, which again would be fundamentally inconsistent with olividity being solely frontal olividity. So essentially, when you add these three parts of the crux up now, Jay's story about the burial being at 7 o'clock is contradicted by Jay himself. The Lincoln Park pings are now irrelevant and likely inadmissible, and the lividity evidence clearly shows this burial could not have taken place in the 7 o'clock hour, which means, in essence, the crux of the state's case is a house of cards that has fallen apart. And I think Justin makes a very strong case here to show that the prosecution really doesn't have a leg to stand on in the event of a retrial.
Yeah, and the state certainly did its best to, whether intentionally or not, obscure this fact in the record by having a medical examiner that didn't elaborate in findings, by having an expert they called in, who the forensic anthropologist, who didn't take a single note or document a single finding. The inconsistency between the lividity pattern and the body's position wouldn't have been as immediately obvious. But there's one thing they couldn't avoid doing, which was taking photographs of the crime scene. And the photographs indisputably show that Hay's right hip was against the ground, and her left hip was not. Which means lividity should have reflected this fact if she was buried there when Jay says she was.
Yeah, I just wanted to address one final thing, because Dr. Levati has noted that the bottom half of the body was basically perpendicular to the ground, whereas the front of the body was a little bit more of an angle. But she's consistently said the body, the upper half, would have to be completely flat for the lividity to match. And one thing she also notes in looking at the crime scene photos is that she was able to detect lividity on the left flank of Hay's body. And the flank, as she notes, is that space between the last ribs, the lowest rib, and the hip. And so if you think about it, that makes no sense, because if the body is at a diagonal, then in that case, you would expect lividity to be more toward the right side. And what she's saying is generally it is centralized, but she was certainly able to detect some lividity in the left abdomen, and under no theory would that make sense with the body positioning here.
She also talks about the issue of rigor in the affidavit and says that according to the way rigor takes place in a deceased person, that would seem to indicate that Hay was buried within 24 hours of her death, though. To me, this is not just about disproving the state's case of when Hay was buried and how it all happened, but also it's evidence of what actually happened to Hay. And so I think that's what like kind of obsesses me, is that if Hay was flat on her face for 8 to 12 hours plus, you know, where was she all that time before she was moved?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's long been my theory that she was not killed in her vehicle, unlike the state's claim. And I think we've discussed various different things, like discounting the theory of pulmonary edema on the shirt and the fact the state didn't test the trunk liner of Hay's vehicle. I think that all strongly supports the theory that she was killed outside her car and she was not in her car until at least 8 to 12 hours after death, if at all. Thank you. Yeah, and then in addition to discussing how the crux of the state's case has been dismantled, Justin then goes on to point out how the credibility of its star witness has been dismantled as well. And of course, some of this is the result of what's been discussed above, but Justin also notes in the motion that since Adnan's case, Jay has been arrested, convicted, or interrogated by the police more than 20 times. Now, some of these incidents involved acts of dishonesty and could thus be used to impeach Jay's credibility at a retrial. So, for instance, in September 2000, Jay was pulled over while on probation based upon driving a vehicle with expired plates and was found to be in possession of marijuana. And when Jay was asked for his name by the police officers, Jay gave his uncle's name and later admitted that he had intentionally lied and deceived the police officer on this fact. And so for all of these instances in the motion where Justin mentions acts of deceit or dishonesty by Jay, under different rules of evidence, Maryland Rule of Evidence 5608B, for example, these prior acts of dishonesty by Jay would certainly be used to impeach his credibility and call into question the honesty and veracity of his testimony. Most of the other incidents, though, involve acts of violence by Jay, and there's one with particular relevance to Adnan's case. And the case mentioned in the motion occurred in November 2009 when a girlfriend reported a domestic assault by Jay based on a dispute over $250. And according to that girlfriend, Jay punched her in the ribs, and when she tried to call 911, he strangled her to prevent her from screaming. And Justin actually talked to this girlfriend, and she told Justin that Jay had strangled her with both of his hands and that she was only able to escape by scratching her way out of his grasp. Now, in our second season case, you might recall how we noted that propensity character evidence is generally inadmissible under Federal Rule of Evidence 404B and state counterparts. So evidence, for instance, that a defendant had strangled or attacked another woman would generally be inadmissible to prove his propensity to strangle or attack female victims, and therefore his likely conformity with that propensity in the case at hand. On the other hand, if the crime at hand and the other acts of violence were similar enough, the prosecution could admit them to prove common plan or scheme, also known as modus operandi or MO. Now, in some other jurisdictions, this same analysis applies when it's the defendant trying to present evidence that an alternate suspect committed the crime charged. In these jurisdictions, defendants are precluded from presenting this generalized propensity character evidence about alternate suspects, but they can present MO evidence, and specifically this is known as reverse 404B evidence. So, in those jurisdictions, Justin slash Adnan would have a pretty tough time admitting these other prior acts of domestic violence and strangulation by Jay. But in Maryland, this isn't the case.
On January 11th, 2000, the same day that someone fatally shot Isaac Dawkins on Highway 27 in Rome, Georgia, the Court of Appeals of Maryland issued an opinion in Sessoms v. State. In Sessoms, the court found that Rule 404B, which is a rule of exclusion, it does not apply to alternate suspects. Instead, defendants are free to admit propensity evidence implicating alternate suspects, so long as it doesn't run afoul of Maryland Rule of Evidence 5403, which states that, although relevant, evidence may be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of the issues, or misleading the jury, or by consideration of undue delay, waste of time, or needless presentation of cumulative evidence. In other words, the baseline presumption is that such alternate suspect character evidence is admissible, and a court shall only exclude it if the value of that evidence has for proving the defendant's innocence is not simply outweighed, but substantially outweighed by one of the dangers from Rule 5403. As the Court of Special Appeals noted in Gravy State, the admissibility of reverse other crimes evidence, that is, evidence that someone other than the defendant committed other crimes or bad acts, is governed by Maryland Rule 5403, under which inclusion is presumed.
So basically, the gist is that if there is a retrial that Justin or Adnan or whoever is, you know, defending him, can actually present these prior acts to implicate Jay as an alternate suspect, right? That's what we can get from these rules.
Well, possibly. That'll still be up to the judge to determine whether or not it's still relevant and if it's not substantially outweighed by other factors. But yeah, there's a decent chance it would come in at trial. Now, whether or not it's valid evidence that Jay is an alternate suspect is another question. And I think the primary purpose here is to show that Jay's value as a witness is gone. whatever the state hopes that Jay could still do for them, whatever the state thinks that Jay could still testify to, all of these reasons will add up to discount anything he has to say in the jury's mind.
Yeah, I mean, much of this motion, I think, in the exhibits attached, this is what Justin is doing. He is showing the state that if you go back to trial, this is what you're facing.
So you know that feeling you get when you can get things done with just the click of your mouse, how convenient that is, how good that feels, and now you can even get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk. That's right, undisclosed listener, you can do that by using Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. You want to talk about convenient? Let me tell you something. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer. Then just hand your mail to the mail person or drop it in the mailbox. You are never, ever going to have to go to the post office again. That means you can just sit at home, lounge in your chair, and listen to our wonderful podcast. That's why we at Undisclosed use Stamps.com. It's easy. We're busy. Busy podcasting, busy lawyering, busy taking pictures of our pets and sending it out over the social medias. So we need it simple, we need it easy, we need to save time, and Stamps.com does all of that for us. So look, undisclosed listener, if you're busy, which you probably are, you need to go sign up for Stamps.com right now. Go to Stamps.com and use our promo code, undisclosed. You're going to get a special offer. Here it comes. You ready? It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. You, listener, right now, stop. Press pause. Undisclosed will be here when you get back. Instead, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com. Enter undisclosed.
Now, even given all of these positive factors, there are factors that cut against Adnan getting release on bail. So first, the order granting Adnan a new trial actually hasn't been finalized because there's a chance that the Court of Special Appeals, or later, the Court of Appeals of Maryland, can reverse Judge Welch's order and reinstate Adnan's conviction. Second, there is the nature and number of Adnan's convictions, because he wasn't just convicted on murder, but there was a first-degree murder conviction. Then it's accompanied by convictions for robbery, kidnapping, and false imprisonment, all connected to Hayes' murder. And while Maryland has indicated that there will be parole hearings for juvenile lifers, it's exceedingly unlikely that Adnan will be granted parole without admitting guilt, which is unlikely to happen. The question then is, what's going to happen now that the bail motion's been filed? Well, it's hard to say because there are so few cases in which a defendant's conviction is thrown out based on a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel, as opposed to state error or misconduct. So if Judge Welch does grant Adnan release, it will probably be with a bail condition in the high figures, money figures, six figures, low seven figures, with accompanying conditions like ankle monitoring or house arrest. But really, it's all a coin flip.
It's a long shot, but Adnan has a strong case for it here. He has evidence to present on every point, and the state is going to have a hard time grappling with the basic question of whether it could even retry Adnan right now. Because even setting aside Urich's own statements and even setting aside Welch's findings in his order, Jay and the cell phone records are the heart of the state's case, Jay especially. Without Jay, without a witness who can stand up unimpeached or give a single story, well, not a single story, but even close to a coherent story that's not been admitted to be perjury, what are they going to do? Without Jay, the state can't win, and it's not clear that the state still has Jay as a witness.
Well, I'm wondering, and whether or not before the state decides if they want to retry or, you know, find an alternate route, would they be able to say, okay, you know what, whatever DNA evidence we can find, if we still have it, we're going to go ahead and test that and then make a decision? Can you do that outside of or before a trial proceeding or anything?
They could test it whenever they wanted. Any day they wanted to, they could.
Well, then you have to ask, why don't they? They should go ahead and do it.
They should.
You know, people say, well, why, how come Adnan won't get it? Like, when a defendant wants, you know, that kind of thing to happen, like, it takes years fighting the state in court. I mean, like, there was a case in Baltimore where I can't remember the name of the defendant, but it took him 6 years to get the state to agree to do the DNA testing.
That was Malcolm Bryant, and he was investigated by Detective Ritz, convicted of murder, and he spent 6 years from his first petition for DNA testing before the state finally gave up. And the idea that a defendant has the ability to just request DNA testing and call it a day? No. Maryland, and Baltimore especially, fights tooth and nail against every such request.
On last week's episode of the podcast Crime Writers On, which is hosted by our very own Rebecca Lavoie, they discussed the bail motion and noted that it sounded less like a legal brief than it was written for the public in mind. I personally think the public may already be more aware, or at least those who have been really following the case, of a lot of the facts that Justin presented. But the courts actually may not be, especially because it's been part of an ongoing pattern of the state to file briefs to the court that contain misrepresentations and outright lies or inaccuracies, if you want to be nice about it. So I'm really glad the facts, actual vital facts, like the lividity, which to me prove beyond a doubt that nothing about how or when Hay was killed, according to the state, is true, that these things are now on the official record. Until now, it's been written about online, in my book, of course, we've discussed it in the podcast, but it's never been presented to a court of law. And the court can actually substantiate everything Justin proffered in this brief because they're going to have access to all the documentation, including all the photographs of the burial site and autopsy, the testimony of the state's own experts at trial who confirmed full anterior fixed lividity, though the body was found on its right side. And by making Jay Wild's criminal record part of the motion, I think Justin was issuing a challenge to the state. This is your witness. Now that you don't have cell phone evidence and the only forensic evidence, the autopsy report, actually contradicts your case, this guy is all you have to hang your hat on. Are you really going to go there? If anything, I hope this pushes the state to finally say, hey, we got it wrong, and it's time to get it right. They have the power to reopen the investigation, to do DNA testing, but all of that requires that they admit they got the wrong person. Or if Adnan is fully ever exonerated in a court of law, they may finally be forced to reopen, and given Jay's record, they could actually go after him directly as the perpetrator. And Jay's been left twisting in the wind, thanks to his own statements, because remember, not even Adnan has ever accused Jay of anything. Only Jay accused himself, and put himself in a deeply precarious position, whether or not he had anything to do with the crime. So now, we have to wait and see what the Court of Special Appeals has to say about Judge Welch's opinion and the Circuit Court has to say about the bail motion.
And that wraps up this week's special episode of Undisclosed. Thanks for listening. Hey, at the top of the program, I told you that the Adnan Syed Legal Defense Trust is still actively soliciting money for his defense. You heard it today on the program. Adnan's lawyer, Justin Brown, is fighting to get Adnan out on bail. If necessary, we're going to use a piece of the trust to fund that bail. But more likely than not, we're raising funds to support his defense efforts in case this thing goes back to trial. Longtime listeners of Undisclosed, you know that this thing was built on trying to help raise money for Adnan's defense. You have stepped up for us mightily in the past, and right now we're asking you to do so again. The Adnan Syed Legal Defense Trust still maintains a home on Launchgood. In the past year, more than 4,000 people across the world have donated. Together, those 4,000 folks have given more than $212,000. That is a lot of money, and we are tremendously grateful for your donations. But if it were enough to cover down on the cost of the legal fees, we wouldn't be asking you for more. Unfortunately, it's not. So this is our ask. Please, go back to LaunchGood and give a little bit in support of Adnan's defense. You can find that webpage one of two ways. I'll give you the easy way first. If you just Google LaunchGood and free Adnan, it's going to be the first link that comes up. However, if you want the entire URL, you can find it at www.launchgood.com/project/the_Adnan_Syed_trust #backslash. We'll also put up a few reminders on our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram page. You'll be able to find the link there. And thank you so much for all the support you've given to date and the support you continue to give. And now on to the credits. Let's thank our sponsors, Warby Parker, new sponsors, Colin, Susan, Rabia, look sharp in those frames. Check out the Undisclosed team's favorite styles. Go get yourself the Mitchell style in Earl Grey color. Put them on, look like Susan, and be that much smarter. Just kidding, those glasses don't make you smarter. But they make you look like it. Blue Apron, our most delicious sponsor. Thank you for continuing to put delicious stuff in my belly, Blue Apron, and for supporting the show. And as always, Stamps.com, thank you. The great folks behind the scenes that produce this show include Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Go check out Actual Innocence because it's awesome. Super producer Methil Telhan keeps it all together behind the scenes. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez on the theme music. Nina Mooser, Christy Williams on the website, Baluki on the logo. John Cryer on the addendum. John Cryer on the addendum? That's right, John Cryer on the addendum. You can tweet your questions at John about today's episode using the hashtag UDAddendum. Hit him up on the Twitters, the Facebook. If your question's good, maybe he'll read it on the air. His show, The Undisclosed Addendum, drops on Thursdays. That'll answer some listener questions about Adnan, too. And lastly, and leastly, the executive producer of Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week. Until then.